Ugh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, lady luck?
Fritzy, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
10 bucks for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome the author, the fiction author, the novelist, J.H. Gerlanter. J.H. is Josh, and I congratulate him on the publication of his first work of fiction, his first book. It is entitled Hold Fast. To get right to the point, this is the Napoleonic era. This is the Royal Navy versus Bonaparte. This is everything we enjoy about Patrick O'Brien's series of books about Aubrey and Maturin, reimagined by a younger man, an American, who has another kind of approach to the Napoleonic era. His hero is a Royal Marine who is also an intelligence agent. The editor of Patrick O'Brien's books over many years, Star Lawrence of Norton, is now the editor of Josh's first book, Gerlanter, J.H. Gerlanter's Hold Fast. That recommendation to everybody who knows Patrick O'Brien. But for those of you who don't, Josh, congratulations. A very good evening to you. Introduce us to Thomas Gray, the officer in the Royal Marines who has a double life. Good evening to you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on. Well, Gray is, the James Bond of the beginning of the Napoleonic Wars. I've been searching for a good, elevator description of him. But I guess that's it. We're right at the transition from the wars of the French Revolution to the Napoleonic Wars. Napoleon is taken over, but he hasn't made himself formally emperor yet. And the English are trying to protect themselves from the growing war on the continent, with everyone else willing to, sign treaties with Napoleon, giving him whatever he wants. The English are a little more reluctant to do that, and they need to know what's going on in Paris. Meanwhile, Gray is despondent over the recent death of his wife and doesn't want to do it anymore and is resigning and moving to the United States. And that's where the book picks up.
Yes, the time period to match it up to Maturin and Aubrey, the time period is the Peace of Amiens, which was signed in March of 1802 and lasted until May of 1803. Josh's story begins in May of 1803, because our hero, Gray, as Josh says, is despondent, is headed to America on a commercial voyage. However, because the peace has been broken by Napoleon, a warship immediately appears and attacks the merchantmen heading to America. And that, of course, makes Gray's fate profound because it turns him back to Europe. However, Josh, I want to come to this in another version, and you will all recall Patrick O'Brien begins Post Captain, the second book, with the same Peace of Amiens, although in that instance it was March of 1802 when Aubrey and Maturin are headed back to London to get a good assignment, and they learn to their despair that the war is over. There's no more opportunity for advancement, but that's not Thomas Gray's problem. His problem is, as Josh says, his wife is dead. Josh, Gray is a figure of your imagination. The intelligence service is a figure of your imagination, but you framed it understandably with the politics of the time. There wasn't a James Bond secret intelligence service until the 20th century. How then did the Royal Navy gather its intelligence? What do we know, Josh?
Well, it's not entirely dissimilar from what it would become in the 20th century. that is sending men from Britain who could speak the language and to meet people and establish networks of contacts in France and Germany and, well, the German states, the Holy Roman Empire, and Spain and so forth. And you see some of it in the O'Brien novels with Maturin, and I think in or Maturin, a subject of great debate.
Yes, it is. I will go with either, Josh, either.
Well, it's having talked to Starr, he has his views on how it should be pronounced, but I've been saying it one way for so long, I find it very difficult to switch. But he gives you a good sense of the intelligence work that was going on at the time, and part of the genesis of Hold Fast was wondering what a book about the Maturin side of their stories, rather than the sea adventure side quite as much, would be like.
We're not aiming to give the story away because it's great fun, and Gray is reckless with his own fate. He throws himself into battle. He's something of a killing machine once he gets going because he's a great shot. But again, the historical frame, there is no intelligence service. There is no master. There's no M in 1803. There's no M, but there is a Banks that Josh gives us, the master spy, the handler. And there is one particular historical frame that's exciting. Napoleon does plan to invade England, Josh. How do you plan to handle that? Because it hasn't happened yet. And Gray comes across that plot quite amazingly. What do we know about Napoleon's plans today, historically? How far did it get?
It got pretty far. It got to the point of the Army of France, as Napoleon called the Army of England, being massed on the northern border of France, and barges were constructed to sail across. And the only thing standing between that army, that invasion army, and England was the Royal Navy in the Channel, which was blockading all of the northern French ports and keeping the army from departing on a crossing, sort of a reverse D-Day going north. And it did get very close, and it was only the breaking out of the War of the Third Coalition that distracted Napoleon enough to have to pull those men off the northern coast and send them into battle elsewhere. But he was, for the duration of his time in charge, he was obsessed with invading England. Something like Hitler. He said that if they could, if France could capture England, then they could capture the world. That was the one thing standing between them and real global domination, because the English fleet, of course, was at the time, sort of the guarantors of peace around the world, in a sense the way the American Navy is now.
Yes, the Americans exist. Thomas Jefferson is the president. You will all recall that Napoleon eventually became disconsolate. He just got discouraged about his plans to take over America. And so then he made the decision to sell what became the Louisiana Purchase to the United States. In fact, we continental United States are the product of exactly this period Josh is writing about. So let's plunge into Paris without giving the story away. We plunge into Paris, a series of happenstances, and our hero is recruited by the United Irishmen. Who were they, Josh?
They were a real historical organization in Ireland when just a year or 2 years after Ireland had formally become part of the United Kingdom. So, today in the 21st century, it's the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. Then it was the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland. And the United Irishmen were sort of a proto-Irish Republican army who were trying to eject the English from Ireland and create a democracy there. It's interesting that actually a lot of the senior figures were Protestant Irishmen, so it wasn't a religious struggle the way we think of it now, but it was, you know, a nationalist Irish view of Irish independence.
It reflects what we learned from Maturin in the Aubrey novels, who was alienated the English crown and yet conducted himself honorably as a member of the Royal Navy. And when I met your presentation of the United Irishmen, this is just a few years after the 98, the planned uprising, the Irish still see themselves as allies of Napoleon. Is that how you understood it, Josh?
Yes. Yeah. And the story touches on the lead up to actual events, and this is discussed a little in a historical note at the end of the book. The United Irishmen were actually doing more or less what they're doing in the book. They were preparing for another attempted rising in Ireland as a follow up to the 98 rising in Ireland, and they were going to expect support from France as they had had last time. And they were gathering munitions, and there was an explosion at one of their munition depots, which sort of gave away the game before it started.
The book is Hold Fast. We're going to have some fun, Josh, when we come back. We're going to go to revolutionary, now Napoleonic, Paris with you and see how things have changed and how they've not. This is a work of fiction. Josh and I are having a lot of fun here, but it's a work of fiction with an historical frame that's never not fun to read about, Napoleonic France and the Royal Navy. J.H. Galerenter is the author. The book is Hold Fast. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World, and I'm speaking with the novelist, the first novelist, J.H. Galerenter. His new book is Hold Fast. It is a work of fiction about a hero who is an intelligence officer with the Royal Marines serving the crown in London in the period 1803. This is now 1803, the spring of 1803. And again, we're not giving the plot away, but there are wonderful characters. There's lots of happenstance. There's a great deal of violence and excitement. And then there is Paris. Josh, take us into Paris as you introduce Thomas Gray. This is the period when they're no longer executing aristocrats. They're coming back. What did Paris resemble at the time in your presentation? What did Gray meet?
Paris was sort of on the upswing again. Napoleon, sort of like, you know, Mussolini wanting to get the trains to run on time. Napoleon really wanted to get Paris back to being the prestigious European city that it had been prior to the revolution. And so he was cleaning everything up. He had just, raised the sort of slum neighborhoods that ran next to the Louvre and the Tuileries. And he's building has just built the first iron bridge across the Seine. And he's reorganizing the city into, you know, carefully numbered postal codes. And at the same time, he's sort of reestablishing a connection between the French government and the Catholic Church, which had been, bitterly oppressed under the sort of anti-religious views of the Jacobins, who had been running the country for the last 8 years. Notre Dame was actually scheduled for destruction, I think, at the time. It was covered in graffiti. It was sort of partly smashed up. Church property had been seized all over the city. Churches weren't allowed to ring their bells to announce mass, and priests couldn't wear their vestments, nuns couldn't wear their clerical clothes out in public, and Napoleon was changing all that. So Paris was sort of rebuilding,
yes,
back to what it had been.
And he's bringing back the aristocrats, including your antagonist, Dumont. And he's restoring lands, or allowing lands to be restored to the Napoleonic aristocracy. You introduce us a great deal to champagne. I did not remember, I'm not sure I ever knew that champagne was disregarded by the French themselves. It appears that only the English cared about it.
The English found the bubbles very amusing. They thought they were a real bonus addition to wine. I suppose the debate about carbonation in drinks has been going on since then, one way or another. But yeah, the French found the bubbles to be a grievous fault, but the English really liked them, and that's what caused the initial burst in popularity of champagne around Europe, and then it caught on in Russia, and then eventually back in Paris.
And here in the 21st century, still a very popular drink hundreds of years later, without any effort by the French whatsoever. We celebrate it and pay premium for it here. One other, because Josh is very good at giving you the details of what our hero runs into. So he runs into champagne. He also runs into a weapon that is magical. And I don't know how to say it correctly. The Girondini rifle?
There's some debate among everyone about whether it's Girondini or Girondoni. But I'm calling it the Girondoni in the book.
It is a repeater. We will not see similar repeaters until the Sharps rifle of the second, or the Spencer rifle of the Civil War. How does it work? What is the genius of it that you discovered, Josh?
It was a real gun. It was the first real functional repeater that made it onto the battlefields of Europe. It just didn't make it very far because it was difficult to produce, very expensive to make, and somewhat fragile once you had it going. But it was basically an air rifle. It had its buttstock was replaced with a reservoir for compressed air. It's sort of like a modern paintball gun. And you would load bullets with a lever, balls individually into an air channel, which would eject them at extremely high velocity. This is the air was pressurized in the buttstock much higher than a paintball gun. It was accurate. It would send. It was like a 46 caliber bullet.
46 caliber. I have the advantage of having just read Josh's novel. 46 caliber, which is a very big hole. Very big hole.
Yeah, it's a big ball, and it was thrown with immense velocity. It was lethal at 100 yards. Could penetrate an inch of wood. And it's interesting that a lot of the detail we have on the functioning of the gun comes from Lewis Meriwether Lewis's account of the Lewis and Clark expedition, because he actually had one of these that he took along with him, and it was one of the reasons for the success of the rifle, not because he ever shot anyone with it, but because as they would cross the country, he would use it to impress the American Indians who he met. It was sort of like a carnival sideshow that everyone got a big kick out of seeing this air gun. Nice basis for friendship with the people they met. But yes. he described it with great enthusiasm, and it's sort of interesting that it never caught on, because it would be a little like the first jet aircraft being invented and then not finding popular military use for another 50 years.
Well, we're aware of that wonderful paraphrase. I can only do it. The future's already here. It's just not well organized. Josh, and you put this rifle in the hands of our hero, Thomas Gray, and he is Murder Incorporated, because it is everything a machine gun could possibly be in the Napoleonic period. Again, we're not giving the plot away. Our hero lives, of course, because there'll be many more opportunities to discern the plans of Napoleon, who was understood as the first world dictator at the time, a genuine threat to the English crown. The book is Hold Fast. I hope we've held back. There's a heroine in the book. There are love affairs. There's a villain. Well, sort of a villain. He's a good bad guy. And And then there is the English intelligence service to look forward to, because our hero, having started out heading to America because he's lost his wife, winds up being called to the Admiralty for his new orders. Josh is J.H. Galerenter. The book is Hold Fast, just published by Norton, by our favorite editor at Norton, Star Lawrence, the man who edited Patrick O'Brien's series and now will edit J.H. Galerenter's series. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. Pacific Ocean. Science Magazine reports the surprise in a new study that there are 500 billion coral colonies in the Pacific Ocean. 80 of the 318 coral species identified are considered vulnerable, endangered, or critically endangered. However, 12 of these 80 at risk, according to the new paper in Nature Ecology and Evolution, have estimated populations of 1 billion each. A recommendation is for a rethink of the critical list. All hours of the John Batchelor Show available all the time on distinguished podcasters such as Apple Podcasts.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend, because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love, with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Stop the podcast!
Stop the podcast!
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids, some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I always on television watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton.
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.